Achievement. Is that you? You think you're someone who's achieved a lot in life? When I think about myself, I think, well, I've probably achieved a few things in my life, but to be honest with you, with increasing age, the thought of death somewhere there around the corner, it sometimes does make me think, just what is it that I have done with my life? Now, for those of you who are older, perhaps you have had similar thoughts to that. You know, I'm old now or heading towards the grave and I look back on everything I've done and really it's not that much. But for those of you here who are just whippersnappers, well, you probably have dreams of the successes that you're looking forward to achieving in life. Now, achievement isn't bad. It's certainly a lot better than failure. The problem is, however, that the wisdom of this world thinks that achievement comes through human self-effort. And sadly, as Christians, we're not immune to that way of thinking. Now, quite possibly, many of you have been brought up in families where it's expected that you will achieve good things in the future. And often there's pressure for you to succeed academically and to get a prestigious, good-paying job. Now, there's nothing wrong with being successful. There's nothing wrong with academic success. There's nothing wrong with seeking achievements in your career. But the mistake is that it's easy for us to leave God out of the equation. Now just think a little bit about Sarai, the wife of Abraham. She knew that God had promised to bless Abraham and his family. I'm sure that Abraham would have shared with Sarai that God had promised him a child and ultimately numerous offspring. And given that Sarai was, at that point in time, Abraham's only wife, it would have made sense for her to understand that that blessing would come about through her giving birth to a child. But she had been waiting for a long time. The promised child had not yet come. We learn from verse 3 that they had already been living in the promised land for 10 years. So Sarai, by this stage in life, was rather old. In fact, she was 75 years old. And even though it seems that back then the lifespan of the average human was much longer than it is for us today, I think we can say that by 75 years of age, Sarah had given up hope that she would be able to naturally give birth to a child for Abraham. So, as is often the case, when believers in God think that he's been slow in keeping his promises, we're tempted to give God a helping hand. Employing that kind of logic, Sarai had a maid, a personal servant, whose name was Hagar. She was Egyptian by nationality. So Sarai came up with what was to her a bright idea. If God has stopped me from being able to give birth, then why not try building a family through Hagar? Now we're not told Abraham's reaction there and then when his wife told him to sleep with another woman. But verse 2 indicates that he didn't have any real strong objection to that idea. In fact, all indications suggest that he was quite okay with that idea. We're told that he literally listened to the voice of Sarai in that matter. So it's more than just agreement. Literally, he listened to the voice of Sarai. Now at this point, we should note that to listen to the voice of someone, in Hebrew, that basically indicates obedience. And the only previous time in the Bible that we get the idea of a husband listening to the voice of his wife was when Adam took and ate the forbidden fruit that had been handed to him by his wife, Eve. Instead of exercising godly leadership, Adam gave in to his wife's beauty and charm, and he joined in with her in eating what God had forbidden them to eat. The consequences of that abrogation of responsibility were huge, not just for Adam and Eve, but for the whole of the human race. And in a similar way, Abraham, in his situation, where he failed to show godly leadership in the face of his wife's suggestion, well, it had the potential to complicate God's fulfillment of his promise to that family. So, Sarai, she takes her maid, Hagar, and literally, as we see at the end of verse 3, she gave her to Abraham, her husband, to be his wife. It all sounds a little bit complicated, doesn't it? A wife giving to her husband another woman to be his wife? It's a complicated and unusual situation, and the text is signaling that for us. But Abraham, well, he went in and he did his duty. And just as Sarai had hoped for, Hagar became pregnant. But instead of that being a positive outcome and a time for celebration, it actually became the cause of tension between Sarai and her maid. On finding out that she had become pregnant, Hagar, the nice, obedient slave girl, became Hagar the Horrible and started to look down upon her mistress and to treat her with contempt. And things got so bad that it led to an argument between Sarai and Abraham. "May my mistreatment be upon you," she said to Abraham. "I personally placed my maid in your bosom." It's literally what it says. "And when she saw that she was pregnant, she ends up treating me like dirt." Here we see Sarai putting all the blame on Abraham. And she even went so far to say, "May Yahweh judge between me and you." Now, it was her idea in the first place, right? But having backfired, she now puts all the blame on Abraham. Now, obviously, Abraham, if you're in that situation as a man, you probably wouldn't feel too happy. It was your idea. Abraham, likewise, verse 6, basically says, "She's your maid. Do to her whatever you want." Basically, "It's not my problem. It's your problem. You deal with it." So what did Sarai do? She goes out and she mistreats Hagar. And things actually got so bad that Hagar ran away. Now, friends, there's obviously a lesson here about how polygamy isn't good for family dynamics. The Bible often describes families where the husband has more than one wife as being families in which jealousies between the wives and disunity among the children abound. There's also a big lesson in this passage about the futility of human attempts to force God's hand. God has his own timetable when it comes to how and when he will bless those to whom he's promised blessing. Now, it's good to be active and efficient and to strive to achieve things in life, but don't make the mistake of thinking that achievement in life is all about me and my efforts. That's what Sarai was thinking. "I need to do something here to force God's hand. I need to do something here to get blessing for my family." But at this point, when we're tempted to do that, we need to take a step back and think, who are we in comparison to God? What are our achievements in comparison to his? There's actually no comparison. We've got it all wrong if we think that we and our actions are the key to life and blessing. In fact, the human race, if left to its own devices, has a terrible tendency of bringing death and destruction rather than life and blessing. Now think about it. Who created life in this universe back in the beginning? It was God, right? Now, if God was the key to life back in the beginning, that means that he's also the key to life both in the present and in the future. So, friends, make sure that you don't forget that fact. Without God, there is no life, no blessing. Without God, there is only failure. And the impotency of humanity in forcing God's hand to try and make God bless us, well, this will actually be signaled in the very next chapter of Genesis, in the covenant of circumcision, when God will in effect give a warning to Abram about using his own efforts to achieve God's blessing. You think, Abram, that you can use your own device to achieve blessing? Well, I'll give the chop to that. The rite of circumcision was a painful reminder of the fact that God's promise will not be achieved through human activity that is independent of God and his will. So there's lots of important lessons that we can learn through this passage. But despite all of that, we do need to note that the main focus of chapter 16 is on the character of God as revealed through his interaction with Hagar. And friends, this is very important because the more that we understand who God is and what he's like, the more we will look to him for life and blessing rather than trusting in our own puny efforts. So let's have a look at how God is described in this passage. From verse 7 onwards, note just how active the angel of the Lord is. Hagar had fled close to 200 kilometres in an effort to get away from Sarai and to return to Egypt, where she had come from originally. The region of Shur is just to the east of Egypt in the Sinai Peninsula. So she'd gone a long way, but the angel of the Lord knew what was happening for her. The angel of the Lord found her beside a spring of water in the wilderness. No doubt she would have been tired and thirsty as a result of her long journey. But the angel of the Lord didn't just find her there. We also see the angel of the Lord speaking to her. Four times altogether. Now, addressing her initially as the maid of Sarai, he asked her where she had come from and where she was going. Hagar answered honestly that she was fleeing from her mistress Sarai. But the angel had an amazing message for Hagar. She was instructed to go back to her mistress and to submit herself to Sarai. The message of the angel of Yahweh there is basically, Hagar, humble yourself and you will be blessed. Humble yourself and God will look after you. Now, being the wife of Abram, albeit Abram's second wife, here we can see that God promised to bless and increase Hagar's offspring too. Her offspring would be so abundant that they would not be able to be counted for number. Here we see that by humbling herself, Hagar would get to share in the Abrahamic blessing. The angel of the Lord also told her that she would give birth to a son, and she was to name him Ishmael, which means in Hebrew, God hears. This is significant. Not so much the name of Ishmael, but what that name says about the character of God. God hears, and he had listened to Hagar's affliction. The word translated as affliction or misery there at the end of verse 11 is actually related to the command given back in verse 9 for Hagar to humble herself under Sarai's hand. In other words, as we are humbled through suffering or through personal humility, God hears. God knows what is happening to us, and he will act in his good timing to extract us from our affliction, to lift us up out of our misery, even to rescue us from the grave. So the name of Hagar's son Ishmael is very, very significant. It speaks to us of the character of the God who hears the affliction and misery and humility of his people. So Ishmael means God hears. But at this point, there was some bad news that the angel of the Lord shared with Hagar. She would have a son, and Ishmael, he would have lots of descendants, but in reality, he wouldn't really be a nice person. Even though he would bear the name God Hears, in and of himself, he wouldn't reflect the character of God as being someone who's willing to listen. In fact, he's described in verse 12 as being a wild donkey of a man, antisocial, a bit of a savage misfit, just doing his own thing and upsetting everyone around him, even his relatives. So a little bit of bad news there. She'll have a bit of a dud as a son. But despite all of that, Hagar's response was, overall, a response of amazement at the encounter that she had just had with the angel of the Lord. And this makes sense, because whenever the angel of Yahweh is spoken of in the Bible, the angel comes across as being not just an ordinary angel, but actually the Lord himself. The angel of Yahweh is Yahweh as he appears to his people. And friends, this is exactly how Hagar responds in verse 13. She called the name of Yahweh who had spoken to her. She said, "You are El Roi," which means in Hebrew, "You are the God of seeing." Hagar, she said to herself, "Truly, here I have seen the one who sees me." So friends, here we can see that God is not just a God who hears, he's also a God who sees. God sees every one of his people. He knows your situation. And we should keep in mind at this point that the verb to see in Hebrew, it really basically in some situations implies not just seeing physically, but if you see something, it also implies responding appropriately to what you see. In other words, the word see in Hebrew can actually be translated at times to mean to provide. Now, some of you might have heard the phrase Jehovah Jireh before. Anyone here heard that phrase? It occurs in some hymns and Christian songs. Jehovah Jireh, which occurs in Genesis 22, is just a Latinization of the Hebrew phrase Yahweh Yireh, which means Yahweh sees. But where it occurs in Genesis 22, it's normally translated as the Lord provides. You see the connection there between seeing and providing? Because when God sees the needs of his people, he acts to supply and to provide what they need. And we see him doing that here for Hagar. In fact, we can even go a little bit deeper here and look at the word provide itself. The word provide there, the end part of it, vide, is actually related to our word video, which means to see in Latin. When you see beforehand, when you foresee something in relation to someone else, what are you doing? The idea is that you see what they need and you prepare yourself to meet that need, to provide what that person requires. So it's not just in Hebrew that we have this connection between seeing and providing. It's there in the Latin and it's come across into our English as well. Friends, the Lord sees his people. He's constantly looking at us, paying attention to what is happening in our lives. He knows what we're going through. He's with us in the good times and the bad times. He's always there to help us and to provide us what we need for life in the truest sense of the word. He is El Roi, the God who sees and provides. And just to mark that fact, we're told in our passage here that the well beside which the angel of the Lord had found Hagar is given a special name. It was called Be'er Lahai Roi. Now, it's not translated for us there in the text, but that phrase actually means the well of the living one who sees me. You see the connections here? And it's totally appropriate that we can see God as the God who sees and provides with Hagar there at the well after her long journey. After a long journey, what do you need? You need sustenance. You need something to drink. Amazing connection here between the water from the well that provided life for the thirsty Hagar. The well and its life-giving water, a gift from the living God who sees. El Roi, the God who sees and provides. So you see how this chapter actually focuses in on God and his character here? It's reminding us that God is the living God who hears and sees. He's alive and active. He observes everything that happens. And as he looks out into the world, he sees his people paying special attention to those who humble themselves, to those who believe the promise that God is the key to blessing. Now, Abraham and Sarai, they tried to force God's hand. But through God's interaction with Hagar, we can see where life and blessing really belongs. Friends, this passage is telling us, in the end, it's not up to us. Blessing and life is up to God to give. He is the God who hears and sees and provides. He is the God who gives life. He is the God who gives blessing. Our role is simply to be humble recipients of his blessing. So friends, in your striving to succeed, which is a good thing, far better being successful rather than being a failure, but in your striving, don't forget the true source of life and blessing.